Our business is built on content. That's our top of funnel is content. It's memes, personalities, shows, content, community, all of that. It's not all product. Product get is what happens to you once you get there. But what keeps you there is we move people from I'm interested in chess to I play chess to I'm a chess player identity to I'm a part of the chess community.
Welcome to this week's episode of Unsolicited Feedback. This week, me and my co-host, Joff Redfern, talk with Eric Alabest, who is the CEO and founder of Chess.com. Chess.com is a super interesting story, and we get into a little bit of it with Eric. What's interesting about chess is that chess has been at the forefront of AI research for a really long time. And so we talk about how AI has changed the game of chess, how it's not only changed the way products like his are built, but also the way it's changed humans and the way that they play the game as they learn from AIs. And I think this has a lot of interesting lessons that we can learn about how AI productivity tools and other AI tools might change the way humans work. This was a super fun episode, a little bit different than what we've done in the past, but I thought that it's been a really awesome conversation and I hope you'll enjoy it as well. Let's jump right in.
I'd love to start with a little mini interview of you and understand a little bit about your history with chess.com, because I think it's been a really interesting story of a business that's like just kept going and kept growing for a long period of time and out of the normal pattern of Silicon Valley fast spike, high venture capital type businesses. So I'd love to hear a little bit about how you got it started.
Yeah. Thanks for asking and thanks for having me here. Chess.com is an unusual business. We did it in a little bit of a different way, as you said. I think our playbook, especially at the time in Silicon Valley in late 2000s, there was a pretty clear playbook of how to build a company. It was get your co-founder from Stanford or MIT and then raise money and set up an office and get a masseuse and everybody gets free lunches and pay the most money you can. Then you're going to do customer acquisition costs as high as you can just to get the maximum number of people. And you're going to do Google ads and Facebook ads and all the ads you can. And you're going to try and find product market fit immediately. And you're not going to worry about money. And you're going to build a great business. And that was the plan. And so we did everything the opposite. Not because we wanted to, but because we had to. Because everybody told us chess was too small, that it would never be big enough. Mm-hmm. Venture capitalists were like, I don't know why you're spending your time on this. It's not a big market. It's not worth it. And you should do something else. You should take the job at Facebook or Palantir or Yahoo or all the other places that were possible places for me. And instead, I said, I think I want to do this. I self-funded. My co-founder was from San Jose State. And we grew 100% bootstrapped. All of our employees were remote, Eastern Europe, Florida, Argentina, Poland, Serbia, you name it. And we had no office and no massages and no free lunches. And
how did you survive?
I had made some money before business school. Yeah, I had sold two other small companies and I had a small amount of money that I could do this with. I also made a fair amount of money while I was in business school doing domain name arbitrage and building businesses, small businesses, and just
amazing. You
know, hacking around
have,
in that space.
Do you have a favorite domain name that you arbitraged or sold that you were proud of? Because back then there was so much availability. Like I have joff.com, which is a convenient name to have. And I had to buy it really early in the whole internet thing.
Yeah. One thing, I made a lot of money helping the owners of uniforms.com. They had a domain name, but it was just a domain name. And there were people who were interested, but our job was to make it as threatening, not as powerful as possible in the SEO game, that a competitor had to buy it. So that was my job. And I did it through building a content site and SEO and making it start to outpace the competitors who were actually selling things. And we weren't. But so they ended up having to buy it. And because I raised the value so significantly for the owners of the domain, and I had carved out like an upside share in that, I basically paid for school and then some by doing that. Anyway.
Brilliant.
That was the kinds of things that I was tinkering around with, but then went on to chess.com, self-funded. And then we decided to become as profitable as possible early on because we go revenue positive through starting to sell subscriptions to chess learning software online. And we did that and people liked it. And then we just grew at the speed of cash.
I'm just curious, what is the point at which it felt like it was working? Does it look like a lot of little step functions, or is it like a steady path for you?
It's about 12 years of a steady path of basically growing 30 to 50% every year in terms of revenue and users and headcount. I mean, when you start from nothing, it's small and then it grows. And by the time we hit the middle of 2018, we were like, hey, this is a decent business. We're going to do $10 to $15 million in revenue. We're profitable. We're in control of our destiny. And then we have 2018, we focused our product a little bit more mainstream, a little bit more fun. And there was like the Good World Chess Championship. We did a Puzzle Rush product that was popular. And we're like, hey, that actually grew the business pretty good. And we're like, oh, maybe this is the high point. And it stayed for about 2 years at that decent trajectory rate of 20 to 50% growth. I think those years were maybe closer to 20 or 30. And then COVID happened. And then PogChamps happened, which was a major Twitch kind of event that just blew up for us. And then the Queen's Gambit happened. And then the media fell in love with chess. And it was this like compounding effect where four waves crested at the same kind of time on right after each other. Amazing. And propelled it so high. We basically 5X'd our business in a period of 6 months.
Wow.
So basically from 15 million in revenue to 80 million in revenue.
And Eric, give people a, because I was on the site this morning, give people a sense of just how many visitors or users you have, games played. It's a really impressive figure.
Given that it's chess and given that everybody told me it was going to be nothing, and that's true. We got 150 or 160 million people have said, hey, I want to play chess, and given us they're signed up for accounts. Of those, we get about 40 or 50 million every month who play and make chess a part of their life. Any given day, it's 5 to 10 million daily active users, peaks and troughs, depending on different seasons and, and billions and billions of games played every year. We're running at a pretty high scale. I like to say we're the highest scale business with the lowest customer value per user out there, which makes our economics a little bit funny because this is free to play. And
how about by country? Do you notice anything as you look across the globe and people come to the site? Do you notice different nationalities standing out?
It's a very global game. The one interesting thing was that during COVID, Italy was the first country to lock down. And immediately our Italian registrations, you could see it per minute rising because people were stuck at home and they're like, we're going to play chess. India was next, and et cetera. I would say right now there's a massive chess movement in India. It's very possible the next world champion or the one after that will be from India. There's a huge generation there, massive momentum, a great scene. And everybody's pretty excited about it. In fact, today, April 4th, is the first game of the candidates, which of the major World Chess Championship. So it's going to decide who's going to play in that. And there's a bunch of Indian kids. I say kids because I'm an old man. They're up and coming, amazing players. So that's the next. But it's very global. You know, it reaches everywhere. We have players from everywhere. It's expanded geographically. It's expanded by gender massively. It's expanded by age group. Before it was older. Right now, junior high schools and high schools are banning chess.com because kids won't stop playing. Yeah. So it's just changed so much over the last 15 years.
You know, what's amazing is because when I was growing up, Russia was such a focus on the chess game. And now if I look at the top 10 rankings, there's only one Russian ranked in the top 10. Is that a shift or was I just imagining that? It feels like they were a powerhouse, right?
Huge, huge shift. There's still some fantastic players. Jan Nepomniachtchi, who is currently playing the candidates and has been runner-up twice in a row. He's a very strong player, but there's still many strong Russian players. It just happens that the rest of the world's been like, hey, we also want to be doing this. But yeah.
Being a product podcast, we've spent a lot of time talking about AI topics here on the podcast. And I think chess is a really interesting analogy for a lot of AI questions in the workforce because AI has been a part of chess since the earliest days. In my first AI CS class, one of the first assignments is build a thing that knows how to play chess, right? And you learn different algorithms around that. I'm curious how you've seen the advent of like advanced AI things change the game, because I think it's an interesting analogy for like how it might change workforce, where we see a lot more AI tools in marketing, in video creation, in creativity, et cetera.
Absolutely. Chess engines, as they're called, have been traditionally called because they start out manually and different punch cards. And there's a whole history of chess engines, but they do two things. One is they evaluate and the other is they search. And so if you think about any decision, you think one step ahead and then you evaluate it. And then you take another step ahead and you evaluate it. And from there's multiple forking tree choices, but you can't evaluate all of them because they explode infinitely. So you have to prune some out. Like, that's a bad idea. We're not going to search anymore there. But you, it's just one step forward, evaluate. Next step forward, evaluate. So search gets smarter and better at saying, we're not going to go down this route because it looks losing early. Let's focus our energies going deeper on the more promising ideas. So that's search. And then evaluation historically was humans coming up with things like queens are worth 9 points, pawns are worth 1 point. If there's a bunch of pieces near the king, that's dangerous for the king. If your rooks control more files, that's better for you. If your pawns are more advanced, that's better for you. Bishops are on an open diagonal or worth more than bishops that are blocked by their own pawns. So they wrote a bunch of rules in the same way that humans evaluate. So we tried to mimic human understanding in rule-based, heuristic-based chess evaluation. And then we would search based on that and say, oh, this is the most promising evaluations. Now we're gonna make these moves. So a chess engine would go deep and evaluate using that. Then the team at AlphaGo created a Go engine that, because Go is a complicated game comparatively to chess in some ways, there's more possible moves and permutations. So they then fed in positions to a neural net, and then it would feel through the net what was good and bad, and self-play pattern recognition that wasn't based on any rules that humans were saying this and that, but it was pattern recognition in the neural net. And then we'll search, but we'll use a neural net to understand the position in a different way from humans. Black box, we don't totally understand. Chess then borrowed that idea with Lila Chess Zero and eventually all chess engines now feed in positions into a net that has limited information and let the net learn itself to evaluate, and then still uses similar tools to search, but they use a neural net for evaluation. That was a bit of a primer. So we are now using black box neural nets to evaluate chess positions. And what has happened is that chess was pretty romantic back in the 1800s. Wild, exciting sacrifices that were probably not objectively good, but they were creative and fun, and humans are fallible, so that it would be these very exciting games. And then over the years, chess got more and more machine-like, and people were better calculators and deeper. And we came into this, what, a chess era of very precise, boring chess games in some ways sometimes that were just very calculated. And everyone thought chess was going to die because it just got stronger and more boring. And the chess engines themselves, Stockfish being the number one, it got more boring during this latest period of search and evaluation. Then the magic of the neural net, it was so much more creative and said, you might think this position is objectively in your mind looks bad, but the potential in this position as the neural net, we see a deeper potential here. And this is actually the best. And so what has happened over the last even 10, 15 years, even more recently too, is that a whole different generation of chess players have come up learning chess from these newer engines that are more creative, that have brought back some of the romanticism and brilliance of the game. And the game has exploded in interest, and the games are more fascinating, more dynamic, more complex, more exciting than ever, all thanks to AI.
Ben, I want to go watch. I feel like I want to go watch a game for the rest of the day. I'm going to go on chess.com and I'm just going to watch games for 8 hours straight now.
I love this because it just shows that there is knowledge that hasn't been unlocked yet, and that it can actually change the nature of a game that looked solved. I remember chess being talked about when I was a kid in the 90s and stuff as like a solved game. Deep Blue figured it out. There's one way to play. And to see that not only is the AI beating humans that you didn't think you could beat, which has been true for, I'm sure, a long time, it's teaching humans to play better, which I think is just so fascinating. And I wonder where we might see this be true in the things we think about outside of games, right? Data analysis or writing or computer programming, that like there are maybe models or styles of creation that we don't even like fully understand yet because we haven't
not enough monkeys have typed out enough typewriters to figure them out yet, to use a bad analogy, I think.
Mathematics is seeing things. Medicine is seeing things. You know, physics is seeing things. I think there's a lot of things still that are yet to be explored. And again, I'm highlighting some of the upsides of this. I think there are a lot of downsides we could also touch on, but it has, to your point, unlocked a lot of interesting human creativity. Mm-hmm. Anyway, I'm with you on this. I think there's a lot of promise along with a lot of peril.
I remember there was like a hot minute where it was as the development of these engines was coming about, where it was better to have a human in the loop. There was a human in the engine and they performed better than the engine itself. But then that dissipated very quickly. And then it was the neural net, the engine itself was superior, a player. Is that true? Any comments on that transition?
Back when, again, when I was in business school, I met some really amazing people. And a bunch of them came from what has been deemed the PayPal mafia. And a lot of those people that were early at PayPal and later went on to do a bunch of other companies, their entire business understanding was what you just said. The foundation of the company Palantir, I was an intern there, was that they would build the best possible tools, but that it would enhance human understanding. The most data, the most rules, you could do all these things, and that humans would, you know, make better decisions along with machines. And the reason that happened is because their entire business at PayPal was built on managing fraud. And this is where Peter Thiel kind of unlocked, and he talked about this when I was at business school, that like they had such a fraud problem at PayPal that they had to develop these amazing tools and then used analysts plus data and all this kind of machine, not machine learning at the time, but rules stuff. And that was the future, was going to be humans plus machines. Now, I'm sure now, to your point, that has sunset in many ways, and that humans now are outpaced massively by these models and now are just making last minute potential decisions or red light, green light, or turning into just automated decisions. Sure. At chess.com, we used to have to manually evaluate every potential cheater on the website based on data. We'd had that same thing. And now the majority of people who cheat on chess.com, their accounts are closed, automated, because it's, hey, you passed the threshold, the rules, the things, this is clear cheating, the machine does the thinking, and your account's closed.
That's amazing. Have you ever played Peter Thiel in chess?
No, he's a better player than I am. I've met him in person once at his house. I talked about an investment at chess.com. He passed. And even though he was deeply into chess, he also thought it was too small. But we did not play at the time. But he did get me the internship at Palantir. So I do appreciate that. I learned.
Eric, I'm curious. You got the feedback that this market is too small over and over again. Yeah. And in a lot of ways, I think if you look at it as venture scale, it probably is. But you've managed to build what I would call a long-term compounder. Right? Like steady compounding growth rates, 20 to 40% year over year. I'm curious, what drove your confidence in this market, even though you were getting tons of feedback? And the reason I ask is, what feedback do you have for people who on its face are working in small markets, and like how to imagine the future? Or were you not thinking that far ahead?
Look, I'm not sure venture capitalists are the people that I would be looking to for determining what's successful or not in life in general. They might be in terms of absolute returns. I was working on a different set of criteria. Was I doing something meaningful? Was I enjoying my life? Was I providing for my family? Was I creating an opportunity where people could work and feel fulfillment and happy? And all of those boxes were checked. And that all you can check all of those boxes without hitting venture scale, right? When we were doing $5 million a year in revenue, and I personally was making more money than my classmates who had taken jobs in tech, I was making more money. I was living my own life. I was providing for my family. I was doing a great thing for the community, and I was managing a growing company. I was so happy. In fact, I was probably happier than I am now in many ways, because I'm friggin' stressed out all the time. And now I have all the pressure of growing. But I was very happy early on. And I would say that if you set your ambitions on building the biggest possible business, like you may or may not succeed at that. But if you want to set your sights on creating a great business, there are great businesses at basically any size and scale. And I never felt the pressure to get big. I never thought Chess could be or ever would be a $1 billion valuation company. I never cared about that. And if I had, I probably would have been miserable for 15 years and given up. But I was very happy all the way through, because it always was growing and it was always exceeding my expectations. So I was very happy with that.
Yeah. I think with the cost of producing things and software just continually to come down over time, like we had the cloud movement, the marginal cost of creating a website comes down with new reasoning engines, the marginal cost of reasoning comes down. I really think there's a number of folks that are going to listen to this podcast and they're going to say the Erics of the world, the Jason Fried's 37 signals of the world, those are people who are my heroes. And I don't need venture capital to actually bring something to life. And like you said, you get to focus on experience. That currency and valuations are not the be-all, end-all way to measure success in life. There are far better metrics out there. So yeah, no, I think you're going to have a lot of fans coming out of this. Not that you don't already. You're going to have more.
Look, I appreciate you saying that. And that's not what I'm after here, but I do want to say and encourage people to potentially reframe on what that success looks like and feels like for them.
Yeah. And fans is probably the wrong word. I think what people look for is they look for others to like people that have paved path. Is it possible? Can I do it? Can I take a passion and build it into something meaningful? Can I support my family? Can I have a good life?
Yeah.
And I think the more examples that are out there of people who've been able to do that, I think it encourages more of that behavior, which I think is really important.
Yeah. And I will say, I'm happy now. I enjoy what I do. Mm. It is very different now at this scale than it was. I enjoyed the earlier days in some ways so much more. And I would just say, I think, again, to your point, I think a lot of people should just set their sights on what their different goals are, and maximizing the business size and outcome and revenue is just a pretty empty pursuit.
What creates that added pressure for you? Did you take outside capital eventually, or is it that now you have more employees and you feel this level of responsibility, or you have more users and you have more responsibility? What's creating that?
Yeah, it's basically everything you said. We went from a company of two people to now a company of 700 people. It's complex. We have multiple business units now, bigger scale, and that's an issue. And then, yeah, just at scale, you have a lot of different things. Compliance is a big issue. Global events are a big issue. You just more on the radar, more different things. And then we did take outside capital. It's a whole other story to talk about why that happened, but we did eventually. And now we're partners with General Atlantic. They're the growth equity company. And I will say that I don't feel pressure from them in like a negative sense of like, must grow no matter what. But I do want to be a good shareholder, you know. I want to grow the product. I want to grow the mission. And I'm enthusiastic and excited by the growth of chess as a game and want to push and support that forward. But it's all positive pressure. It's none of it's negative pressure. Once you grow, where are we going from here? I don't want to see chess in decline. I don't want to say, oh yeah, chess peaked in 2023. That was the end. I don't want to see that.
Can you maybe share just one bit about why you chose to take money after shunning it for so long?
Okay. Someone was like, hey, I want to invest. And we were like, oh, we don't want any investors. And they said, we want to invest. And we're like, what are you thinking? And they gave us this term sheet that was like garbage. And we're like, no, if you just want to buy secondary and be equal to all of us, like you can do that. He's like, I love chess. I'm in this forever. And then we're young people and we're like, oh, we want to buy houses and support our kids and take a little money off the table. So we took a very small secondary and we're like, oh, this is great. This is fine. We'll operate and do well. And then everything was great. And 3 years later, hey, I got to get out. I'm like, what? You said you love chess. You're in forever. He's like, I got to get out. I got some investors. I thought this was all your money. No, I got to get out and I need a return and I'm getting pressure. But hey, I lined up another person who loves chess. And I'm like, and so I meet this guy. Oh, he's like a billionaire and he loves chess. I'm like, oh, perfect. This is our perfect investor. He's going to come in, support the mission. He'll be here forever. Maybe we'll put chess in like a permanent trust and it'll just grow. And who cares? It's not a thing. He invests. You know, but he's like, I want more. And we're like, okay, a little more money off the table. Let him in. And I'm like, oh, this is forever. And then 3 years later, he's like, hey, I got to get out. I'm like, what? Why do you got to get out? Like, this thing's that he just, I just got to get out. And so then we started the process and I met like a ton of private equity dicks. I'm sorry to everyone I talked to. I really hated most of you, but I did end up with General Atlantic, who I really liked. They were amazing. And they have continued to be so far
fingers and toes crossed. But I've really enjoyed Tanzine and Anton and the whole crew at General Atlantic. They've been very supportive of our mission. They're very much supportive of founder-driven. They love community-driven businesses. They love consumer non-CAC businesses, and it's been great.
Eric, I have a single question for you. How long have you been with General Atlantic? Has it been 3 years?
It's coming up on 3 years.
All right, man. We're coming back. You're coming back on this podcast.
Oh, I know.
Yeah. Those I guys know. Are, I'm putting them on warning, man. Yeah. You better stand up. Man, if you let Eric down, you're letting down 170 million chess players who love this site. Stay strong, people.
Yeah. The great thing is actually the whole team there is all addicted to chess.com as well. So Tanzine and Jesse and everyone else is like playing chess like crazy. Gord and the whole team there. I agree with you, though. We'll see what happens in 3 years.
Eric, I have a question for you. So 7 months ago, I changed from being an operator. I grew up as a product leader my entire life, but now I'm a venture capitalist. And I wanted to make better decisions. Like I want to make better decisions. So part of it was I read the book and then there's a website that's set up where you can make forecasts. And then from those forecasts, you can figure out how good you are and how not so great you are. And I really found that fascinating because I'm a strong believer that, you know, you got to put your reps in to improve when it comes to strategy and making investments and things like that. So you've mentioned I can go to chess.com. There's settlers. There's online versions of it. There are other things. Do you ever run into like other things I should be doing? If I want to be a better strategist, like I want to be a better strategist, I want to be a better investor. You got any more advice for me?
Chess is all about pattern recognition and they call it chunking, meaning that's how your brain assembles information in these little chunks. In fact, a very interesting study is they took chess masters and random non-chess players. And then in front of them, they put different chess positions, gave them some time to study those positions, and then took the pieces off, then said, set back up these chess positions. Mm-hmm. And what was amazing is that the chess masters, for the positions that were normal chess positions from that you could possibly see in a game, the chess masters could remember and set all of those positions up so much better than the random person. But when the chess positions on the board that they had set up were completely not things you would ever see in a chess game, where like kings are next to each other and they're in corners or just random sprinklings of pieces that make no sense, the chess masters were no better at being able to reassemble those positions than the non-chess player. Because it's a pattern recognition thing that over time you build your brain and build your muscle. And so I would say that doing reps inside of anything, but it should be tangential to the types of things that you're doing.
The game that you're playing.
Yeah. Yes. And so you can do now learning that skill across a lot of different things. It can become habit forming and you can apply some of those same principles to your life. And but it's not, hey, if you do chess puzzles, suddenly you're going to be a better investor.
Yeah.
It's not what anyone's saying about chess, but the process of getting better at chess puzzles will improve your process at getting better at other things. Those are the transferable skills that I teach kids to patiently look at things. You teach people to think about things in terms of steps and evaluation and strategy and pattern recognitions. I agree with you that spending more time doing more forecasting will make you better at forecasting.
Yeah, one piece of advice that I've gotten, and this was a while back, but I've been thinking a lot about lately is not thinking about the probabilities, but thinking about the possibilities. Because when you're looking at something that you're potentially investing in, it's so easy for us to tear something down versus to build something up. Yep. So when you actually sit there and say, sure, there's a lot of things that are going to make this business hard, but if it were to work, what might that look like? I remember the first time that Reid Hoffman told me about Airbnb. And I was just like, wait, so some stranger's going to sleep on my couch. They're going to use my kitchen. They're going to use my bathroom. And that's like a good idea. You're investing in that. And then today, as I travel, I really love traveling with Airbnb because I feel like I'm traveling like a native. You get there and someone opens up their home to you and you're like, oh, where should I eat? And they're like, don't go to this tourist section. Like the last time I was in Italy, they're like, don't go over here. That's very touristy. go over here. If you want, you can mention my name. They know me. I grew up with this guy. And it's just like a totally different experience. But you really had to think about the possibilities of that business over the probabilities when you're first looking at it.
Yeah, I think it's in a lot of people's human nature to look at all the potential downsides of something and then fixate mm-hmm. on those and then use those as reasons to not either do the thing or participate in it or whatever, or invest mm-hmm. in it. I'm with you. If you can see the possibilities and the upsides there and use the vision. Again, it may be a low probability, but if you're in venture, you're in a small probability
business. Yeah, it's an outlier business for sure.
So Eric, as we discussed in the earlier part of the episode here, Chess has been at the forefront of AI, machine learning type topics for a long time. And you've talked about this already in terms of how it's made human players better, how it's changed the style of the game. I think the next question I want to ask you is like, how has the changes in AI changed chess.com, the product, as my first set of questions? Like, how are you thinking about it and its opportunities for your product and for your customers?
Yeah, appreciate that. It's something that is a big part of what we do, and it touches so many different areas of our product. For example, one area is that in the past, if you wanted to play the computer, you could dumb it down either through worse evaluation or lower search. And you bet you'd play the computer level 1 to 10. But we changed that through a lot of these techniques about AI, about shaping how it plays and changes and different rules. So now we have all these different types of personalities. So you can play against the computer in so many, it's just a vast range of different play styles and different fun things that happen through it. So we've made playing against the computer more fun and more human-like through AI. So that's one thing that we've done. Another thing is that people want to understand the game better. So we have a major project ongoing to modernize our game review product, which helps you analyze your games. And instead of being a bunch of if-then statements and, you know, heuristic code, to now LLMify it in many ways. The problem with this is really fascinating, is that because the way LLMs work is they use predictive text. It's the world's best predictive kind of what to say next. And so you aggregate all this knowledge and you can end up in chess saying some really stupid shit. Because let's say in an artistic world or in literature world, there's no hard lines. You can say something and it can flow. But chess is a very concrete game.
And so it
ends up phantom creating things that don't move. Oh, just move the knight one square forward. That's not a legal chess move. Or it will predictively say, for example, there's a funny position where it's one king against a king and two bishops. Now, you can checkmate with the two bishops and your king, but the way you do that is very precise, but it will give advice like move your king toward the center because that's good in the end game. But they're completely wrong from a concrete point of view. It's just predicting things you might say in a very general way in there. And so we're seeing the friction of the potential of LLMs, but with none of the governance of like actual fact and reality. Very similar to Google's problem. The fact and reality was that Nazis were white, and yet they couldn't do it because the fact and reality weren't governed. And so there's some of these problems. And so in my view, somebody is going to make a lot of money, not by predictive LLM style what might be next, but having the right set of data and governances that sit on top of that to make sure that what comes out isn't bullshit. And aggregating actual factual data and using that to govern and guide the LLM is someone's going to control that data and facts. And again, facts are no longer facts, I guess, climate change and whatever else. So it's a little bit tough, but that kind of governance, we're working on that at chess.com on a very micro scale within the facts of the chess realm, but that will extrapolate out larger.
We have things like RAG, where we're going to take, for listeners that don't know, in the LLM world, RAG is where we might have a database full of a bunch of facts, and then we marry those facts with the response coming from the LLM to get us a cleaner, more, an answer that hallucinates less. Are you saying that there's maybe something beyond RAG, or do you think perfecting, right? Because that's still a relatively, when I go and talk to enterprises, they're just starting to implement RAG as they build out their products.
But even with RAG, I'm not an expert on this, but it is, you're basically stuffing the you're like adding context to the general LLM, but it is still just generating next tokens, generating text. Now, it should be a little better because it has that information, but knowing what to give it, what context to give is hard. And I think this question of what's the loop that sort of asks the question, is this result factual? Now, let's ignore all the blurry factual pieces that you talked about, the politics, the things, but like in rule-based things, I've seen this with math as well. Sometimes when I ask it to do math, it makes like basic math errors at times. And if I say, hey, you made this mistake, and I'm a decent enough person at math to identify that it was wrong.
Yeah.
Like you made this basic undergraduate or high school level error, fix it. It can do it. But if you were to just follow its logic, you would end up in the wrong place. You would have the wrong code, the wrong result, the wrong thing.
Yep.
So I think this is an interesting question of, it's not, I think you can fix some of it, Joff, by giving it better upfront context. Cool. But part of it is that there's nothing checking the output. I would love to hear a true AI expert's view on how to solve these problems, because it's super interesting. Cool.
And I'm also not an AI expert. I don't know the in-depth understanding of how tokens generate next predictive stuff. But in the world of chess, for example, you're always, again, doing a search and then doing an evaluation and then doing the next search. And that's it's partly predictive, but at least you're doing a search on facts. And I feel that like somewhere in what you said, Fareed, of as it tokens and predicts forward, that you would have a factual check along the chain somewhere, that it's actually searching logical, factual things to say and excluding out the hallucinations in the process of the thinking, not just like a governor at the end or something like that.
Right. Let me ask a different question. So you're using the LLM to help evaluate my game.
Yep.
And one of the things that I saw over at Spotify, in fact, I met the guy who was responsible for creating Max, which is their AI DJ. And one of the things that really struck me, he and the team had spent so much time figuring out what Max as a personality should be. They spent a lot of time with naming it, picking the right voice for it. And I think it's not going to work for everybody because there's too much variation in the human population as they listen to music. But what does surprise me is that it works. Max works for a surprisingly large number of people.
Yeah.
Like when I listen to Spotify and I turn over DJing to Max, I really enjoy it. Like it has a personality and the way that it talks to me. And I hear that in the inflection in the voice, the words that it chooses and things like that. So did you have to give a lot of thought to the personality of the game reviewer?
This is a huge part of what we're building right now. So we're basically we're coachifying chess.com. So you will have a coach character that goes with you, especially for newer players. And if you're an advanced player and don't want it, fine, turn it off. But in the same way that Duo guides you along with Duolingo, they have a definite personality and a context there. We're going to be coachifying chess.com. But the thing about chess.com is there's a ton of personalities already in the game. And there's a lot of different things. And so we're trying to build multiple personalities so that when you come in, you can choose. Do you want the very soft-spoken coach that helps you here? Mm-hmm. Do you want the hip, modern Botez sister to do this thing? Do you want jerk coach who basically taunts you and makes fun of you? And so we're working on all these different types of voices.
That's super cool. Yeah.
That will tell you different things. And so the AI will be able to say, okay, given the style of, let's take all the YouTube videos that the Botez sisters have ever done or that Hikaru Nakamura has ever done, let's take the text out of it. And now when we output in the LLM, let's do it in the style of things that they say. And then one step even more fascinating is that then you take that and you put it through voice generation and you can mimic someone's voice basically perfectly, very easily. So now you can have a real life coach avatar that can just talk to you and be your coach.
So now branching to the next piece. So we talked about how AI has changed chess, the game. Talked a little bit about what AI might do for the future of the chess.com product. I'm curious how it's changed chess.com, the company, and where you're seeing the biggest impact or the biggest opportunity for how it might change the way you work. And the reason I ask you this, and I think it's really interesting, is your ethos around building and being profitable and growing in a really deliberate and smart and thoughtful long-term way, I think means you, I hope it means you're looking at this pretty closely.
Yeah, there are so many different avenues that we are in different stages of implementing or looking at. And there's various different vendors that we're looking at who try to solve these problems for you or give you promises and different things. We're currently implementing this in our support software where the AI can find answers, recommend answers, and we're tweaking through that process. The truth is that the quality is lower, but the response rate is so much faster. And I think that will end up being an area where it will be human enabled, where a lot of it will be done, but a lot of humans will be able to help make that better for people who have repeat and a bunch of things, a higher quality of touch for our premium members and different things. We're seeing this with our engineers as we've given them the green light to use AI to help them code and whether different co-pilots or different types of things to help them solve and do this. So we're seeing productivity improvements across our engineers. We've seen the impact of this on our fair play and our cheat detection type technology where we're investing in more tools to help us be smarter, both algorithmically and heuristically and machine learningly to understand what cheating is and what is human play versus non-human play and how to touch the signal versus the noise and determine that. We're seeing, obviously, in the business realm, there's a lot of companies who make monetization choices and pricing and all these different things through kind of machine learning models. And we're at the earlier stages of that, of building out capabilities of understanding our users. And we also ethically aren't in a place where we're going to be like micro maximizing every dollar from every user. It's just not in our ethos. But I know that does happen in a lot of gaming and in mobile gaming and stuff. We're also looking at it for fraud and for abuse and scammers and spammers. And when somebody signs up, are they a bot? Are they a real person? Are they a crypto scammer? And then the challenge on that one for us is, okay, we have 100,000 signups a day. Are we going to now hit some other API and pay all this money for them to do it? Or are we going to build our own in-house capabilities? And are we going to build that in what technology is that on? Is it a neural net? Is it an LLM? Is it a this? So these are all so many different areas of our business are being touched by this.
Yeah. Go to the cheating one.
Yeah.
I'm curious, like, why do people want to cheat? What's the motivation? Is it sex, fame, money? Which one of those things is, what are they trying
sex
to do here?
For sure.
Yeah, exactly. I go to jets.com to find my mate the next day.
There's a deep human drive to win. We survived by winning. If you watch Chimp Empire on Netflix, which is a great show, you see basically humans at their most primal. People want to win. It doesn't matter. Winning means survival. That's in our DNA. And how you win doesn't necessarily matter if you don't have a governor or a moral compass on top of that. Or even if you do, in the heat of the moment, it can get overridden by just the primal urge to win. So that brings out the best of competition and also the worst of human instincts. So people cheat to win. People also cheat because of the anonymity. They have a low empathy because they're not connecting with a real person. It's just some username of some person who lives in a country. Yeah. I don't know. And so there's a low human connection. And so, people cheat a lot and we catch a lot of cheating. And it's a sad and hard part of our business. I think about how great our business could be if we didn't have to spend any time fighting fraud and cheating and scammers and dealing with abuse. We could elevate the product a lot more.
Yeah, I have a saying that's like, any product, no matter how simple, is complicated at scale. And this is because there are scalability problems of every kind. There's the scale of technical scale, which is hard as you grow, no matter what you are as a product. But then there's human scale, which I think is even harder, which is like, how do humans behave in a system that is at scale? So at Instacart, for instance, when you have a million people ordering groceries and 0.1% of them cheat their shopper by messing with tips to under tip, that becomes a huge problem instead of a small one-off problem, right? And I think the more networked your product is, which yours certainly is, right? People are interacting with other real humans. The bigger a problem those things become. Let me ask a sort of weird question, which is, okay, so cheating is human nature in some respects. Why does it matter? How do you think about why stopping cheating is important? What impact does it have on the system? I think I know the answer, but I'm just curious to hear you articulate it.
There's two different realms that this matters in. One is in the professional community, and then the other is in the amateur casual player right. community. So in the professional community, it matters because money is on the line, and because yeah. careers are on the line, and because people are playing and competing at the highest stakes for actual, like, material things. And there is so much that goes into that. And our dealing with cheating on a professional level in our events is almost an entirely separate problem in some ways okay. than in the amateur realm. And so we have a whole different set of initiatives. We're working on proctoring software and all sorts of different things that are going to go into that realm. Now, right. on the casual level, truthfully, if you're an 800 rated chess player, which is average on chess.com, and you are playing against someone who's actually a 400 rated chess player, but is cheating to be like an 800 rated chess player, you're probably never going to notice and you're probably never going to care. So it doesn't really matter. The problem is when you're playing against someone who's roughly your same strength, but then they blow you out of the water and you just right. know and you feel bad and it just feels wrong. Or you saw that they were bad for the first half of their game, but then they got pissed and started cheating for the last half of their game. And you're like, I played against two different chess players in this game. The problem is what we've actually learned is people are horrible predictors of if people have actually cheated or not. Because then once they get the idea planted in their mind about cheating,
right.
they go and lose the game and they're like, that person was cheating. It's really actually yeah. you just played a bad game. Or you yeah. got in your own head about it. And yes, there's a problem, but the problem that exists in people's head is even bigger than the reality of the problem. And so right. that in and of itself is a problem. So there's a lot to unpack inside yeah. of this topic, for yeah. sure.
What kind of dollars are at stake for the pro players?
Chess.com pays out millions of dollars in prizes to professionals every year.
Wow. Well,
it's significant.
I'm curious on the amateur side, is it really that if I believe there's cheating on the platform, I'm less likely to use it and I'm less likely to retain? Is that sort of the like rough like way it feels out? Or if I lose a lot to people my same level, I'm less likely to stick around? Are those the types of things that you're trying to prevent there?
Yeah. If you have a negative experience, if you feel like you were treated unfairly, you're unlikely to want to do that thing again. Now, right. again, the percentage of people who actually face cheating for most people is so ridiculously small. It's like minuscule. It's 0.1% or less, right? Of all the games. Because people who cheat generally cheat their way to the top and they get close and et cetera. So for most players on chess.com, it is not relevant. And someone who does cheat, it's a very big outlier at that level and they have their accounts closed. Right. But the perception of it is a problem. Because if you lose the game and you can't deal with your own loss and then you blame it yeah. on cheating, then you're like, I don't want to play this anymore because they cheated. So that is part of the problem that we deal with.
So interesting.
People who come on chess.com and play their very first game against another human, if they win that game versus lose that game, what is the likelihood that they will retain as a user? It's 4x.
4x. Yeah. I was going to guess double.
Yeah.
4x.
So that creates a moral conundrum for us. How do we win your first game? If you maybe you play against a bot and then that's the first, then you may guarantee they win. But then do you tell them they're playing against a bot? Now are you being dishonest? And then do you make them play against an easier person than their real skill level? And that's now unfair to a whole bunch of different reasons. It's really a moral problem here that we've basically just said, you know what? We're not going to solve for this necessarily, except we're going to say, hey, we encourage you to play against this virtual coach to get your feet wet. And then we can guarantee that they're playing at their level and probably win their game. But these are things. Humans are deeply wounded. My pride. I lost the chess game. I'm out of here. So
have you ever considered? Yeah. Have you considered forcing new users onto a single player bot? Or is it that because there are people of varying skill levels entering, it's hard to be like, go play against this elementary school bot kind of thing? Because that's what we would have done in gaming. You'd have a single player experience before you go into PvP or group play or anything like that as a way to ease your way in. Is that just harder to do with your customer base?
it's harder to do. I'm also a gamer and I don't love when that's done to me. Right. And we try to build products that we want ourselves want to enjoy. That said, I love that book, Nudge. And so we're going to be using more nudges to help people have more positive experiences, but not in a coercive way. And if someone's like, I just want to go play another person, fine, you can go do it.
That's great. You've identified one of your moments. Most products have these things that highly correlate with a successful onboarding or long-term success. Like at LinkedIn, it was at the moment in which you had accumulated 30 connections, then your likelihood of having a long, enduring relationship with the product was far better than if you had not achieved the 30 connections. Was there any other like moment? So winning your first game was a clear indicator. Any other telltale signs of if you did X, you were going to have a much better experience?
Yeah, friends are also super important on chess.com. Right. What's interesting is that in the past, it was people came to chess.com to find people who would play chess because none of their friends did. But now people are using chess.com to play chess with their coworkers and their actual in real life friends. And that's a different thing than it was 10 years ago.
Was that a COVID shift?
It's a COVID shift for sure. It's a Queen's Gambit shift. It's all those things. And so now that there's so many more people playing, that chess.com is very much a social network at this point too, in addition to being a gaming site. So there's that whole element of that. I do want to also say something very interesting, which is, yes, people love to win, but chess is this interesting game. A lot of people have said, hey, you've got to make chess like easier. You've got to do things to just make people feel better. But I think one of the reasons that chess has been successful is that people do have a love-hate relationship with the game. And that hate drives them to love it and do it. For example, one of our most popular products was a chess bot named Mittens. And it was the hardest bot that you could possibly make with the engine at maximum level. And even harder because we made it aggressive and all these things, and then put a cute cat on it. And then it had this bizarre kind of conversational mechanics behind it. And people loved getting destroyed by Mittens. It was like a funny thing. So
they know what they're getting into, right?
I can't wait till you get thrashed by Mittens after our conversation.
Yeah, so Mittens on break, but yes.
Yeah, super interesting like lesson there, which is it's not about winning and losing, which would drive you to this, make the game easier thing, but rather like it meets my expectations. And like my expectations as a beginning player are not to get smoked by a grandmaster, right? Like in my first game. Yeah. And my expectation as a great chess player is not to crush a beginner. Right? It's in the middle. I wonder if there's more to that 4X, which is that there's actually a continuum of game outcomes. And it's winning is obviously like exciting versus losing, but I would love to dive into, is it close? How long does it take? How interesting was the outcome? Did I make a blatant mistake? There's things like that that I wonder whether there's so much more nuance in that 4X activation question than is on the surface that would lead you to do bad, evil, gross, fake things versus nuanced Mittens type solutions, which I think are really interesting.
But it is a fascinating thing because, yes, we have what we call like the game shape or the game arc, which is who was winning. Was it a very even game and then one person made a mistake at the end? Or did somebody get consistently outplayed? Or were you losing but then got lucky? So there's all sorts of game shapes that we have. And so, that could be a very interesting predictor of how people feel after their game, which is the most satisfying game shape to that. I'll say one other thing that we have found, which is super fascinating, is that people, as we know, have a bias that their losses feel more painful than their wins. And so someone might win five games out of 10 games, might win five and lose five, but they definitely felt like they lost more because they recognize that. And what we did some research and what we found, and especially with our puzzles product, people were demoralized. They're like, I should be getting all of these puzzles right, or I feel like I'm getting all these puzzles wrong. But we were really just trying to give you puzzles that you would get half right and half wrong so you would have an accurate chess rating. Because when you play people who are roughly your level of chess skill, you should win half and lose half and then draw a percentage as well. You should have this kind of equilibrium. But no one wants to feel the equilibrium because they actually feel the negative of the equilibrium. And so people want to have this like rating that shows what they are, which shows they win half and they lose half. And as you adjust that, your rating goes up and down.
But what we found, especially through our puzzles product, that people actually are most satisfied when they're getting about 80% right. They don't want to get 50% right and 50% wrong. Yeah. About 80% makes them feel like they're getting about half right and wrong, which is just absolutely wrong for the human brain.
That I wonder how much of that is driven by school. As if the distribution of grades on an exam was 50%, like everyone would be miserable, not just the people who are in the middle, right?
Yeah, no, I agree. It feels like there's something I've always admired, like that flow psychology, mm-hmm. where when you're working on a task and they say, hey, look, if the task is too easy, it's boring. And if it's too hard, it's frustrating. So you're trying to find that thing in the middle, which is flow, where it's just enough that you're continuing to learn and push yourself, but not so much that you're completely frustrated by the exercise. And yeah, it sounds like that's more like a 80-20 thing than a 50-50 thing.
I think it is, but at the same time, it's working. Like, this algorithm is working to get you paired. And I think it is. It does put you right in that zone where maybe you're perceiving more frustration, but it's right in that challenging zone. And people just always believe that they should be rated a little higher than they are. Yeah. So they're always hoping and they can get there. And then, yeah, there's a period of demoralization, but then you're actually playing easier people. So you bounce back and then you hit your upper limit and it gets more frustrating. But then again, so we watch this and it's a very fascinating thing. And you're right. If chess were too easy, it would be boring. And if it were too hard, it would be demoralizing. And chess, the rating system keeps you in that band of just human struggle that you want to be in.
So I'm going to start playing Fareed here, and I want to be better than him. So what should be my strategy? Are there a few strategies for how I come up the learning curve even faster? Because I'm a fairly average chess player.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think these are things that everybody can know and should know. And I actually think these are fairly broadly applicable lessons. Number one, is control the center. Because that's where the action is going to happen. And if you control the center, you can control the areas around it. It's like controlling the high ground in a battle. You want to be where you can see the most and get to the different spots. So control the center with your pawns and your pieces. Okay. The next is bring all of your resources into the game. Develop all of your pieces into the game. And that means get your knights out. Get your bishops on good squares. Don't just leave your rooks in the corner. Bring them into the middle of the game where the action's happening. And I think, again, that's broadly applicable in life. Of a lot of times, people just keep focusing on one thing or just doing a small part of the potential, and they're leaving behind a whole bunch of other things they can bring to the battle. And so getting all of your pieces in the game. That said, you want to castle and get your king out of the middle, and you want to protect what's most important to you. And so put that to the corner. So usually you want to control the middle with your pawns to start. Then you bring your knights out. Then you bring your bishops. Then you castle. You protect your king. Put them in the corner away from the most of the battle. Bring your rook into the game and then control that. And a little bit like life, right? Like your mental health. Maybe that's your king. You want to take care of that first so that you're in a good spot. So that's why for me, physical exercise every day, that's a little bit like me castling and taking care of myself so that I can bring my best game to work and everything else. So castling. And then the thing that people fail to do the most as beginners in chess, which is so fascinating, and this is another human psychology thing, is they are so focused on their own moves that they almost don't even pay attention to what the other person did. Someone else will threaten, bring their bishop out, attacking my queen. And I'm like, I'm just focused on what I'm doing. I'm not even going to take the time to look at their move. And what's the possible, they could take my queen, or they could capture my thing. So what is it about humans that we get so focused on our own plans and our own ideas that we don't take the small number of seconds it takes to say, okay, why did that person do that thing? What was they had a reason? And this is a very human thing, because when you get in a conversation, most people are talking at each other, not with each other.
Yeah.
And they're thinking, when the other person's talking, they're thinking about the thing they want to say next, and they're not hearing it. They don't validate why they said it or what they're doing. And they just end up talking at each other and arguing because they're just trying to put their own thing. But if you get good at listening to someone else and validating what they have to say, you can almost disarm everything and be a better and win that conversation or win them over to you by validating and understanding. And so that same lesson in the chess position of, let me take the time to respect my opponent enough and that they actually did something for a reason. Mm-hmm. And if I can validate that reason and give it the respect it's due, I will see it and I can handle it and I can either prevent what they're doing or take advantage of what they're doing or defend against it or say it's not a threat and now I can do what I'm doing. But that's probably the hardest thing for people to do is just take the time to see what the other person is doing.
Man, those were really good life lessons in there too. If you weren't doing chess.com, what would you be doing?
On the business side, I would love to be doing more in gaming. My heart is in that. I love it. My youngest son, who just turned 16, is already a game developer and designer. Cool. And he wants to do his career there. Something in there would be super fun and fascinating. But outside of the world of business, this is almost embarrassing to say, but I love pickleball and disc golf. Those are my hobbies and my heart is in those things.
Man, pickleball's come on with just a vengeance. So much to say about pickleball. That's a whole nother podcast.
And so cool. I've actually been doing a little, because chess has had such a fascinating story on the product side. And we talked about that today, but we didn't spend any time talking about this, about the media side of chess. How on earth did chess become so popular? The product is a huge part of that, but a massive part of our story is media. Netflix's media, our own media, the personalities, the creator ecosystem, the memes. Guys, our business is built on content. That's our top of funnel is content. It's memes, personalities, shows, content, community, all of that. It's not all product. Product is what happens to you once you get there. But what keeps you there is we move people from I'm interested in chess to I play chess to I'm a chess player, identity, to I'm a part of the chess community, community. And that has a lot to do with content. So I'm now helping other companies in some ways doing a little bit of advising on how to help other companies take that same journey. And Fareed, you talked about this a little bit of like, how do you build brand in the future? How do you do customer acquisition in the future? What are the channels? How are people going to build brand in such a virtuous cycle where SEO is very winner take all and the algorithms can be winner take all, but there's a branding piece and personality in media is such a key part of a lot of that. And it's really been a lot of the secret of our success. And I think is a green field for businesses that are trying to get into it.
I feel like you should brand that. Just the way you described that progression, like this Maslowian progression of moving from outside the chess community to becoming someone who identifies as becoming part of the chess community, that's fascinating.
As I think about the things that I have been most engaged in as a consumer over the past 3, 4 to 5 years or so, a lot of them have followed that progression. And I think this is an interesting why can small markets be big is because you can move people. You can actually be an active participant, not just wait for people to be, I am a disc golf player. I am a member of the chess community. You can actually not just wait for them to get there, but actually move them along and turn this I'm interested into I'm obsessed and be a part of that. I've seen this. I am part of a golf community in a lot of ways in a bunch of things. And you see it with podcasts, YouTubers, clothing brands, like those hoodie I'm wearing today, and many other things, gear, et cetera, that they are not just explicitly targeting the people at the end of that funnel. They're actually working hard to pull people along, to go from interested to obsessed insider. And you certainly see it with pickleball. And it's interesting how these other pieces then have come out. Like someone will make, if you have an obsessed community, someone will make a Netflix show about it or whatever it is, that then other things are pulling into that as well. I think that's a great lesson for people chasing what look like niche markets is ask yourself, are there people who will identify themselves as one of their top three things is I play chess or I'm into chess? And what can you do to pull people along? Such an interesting insight.
Yeah, I think, as you said, maybe they make a show about it. The popularity of Formula One, just based on the Drive to Survive show, has been massive.
Right.
I'll tell you that we saw this. And so toward the end of this year, you'll see a pretty big show on Netflix about chess and the chess cheating scandal coming out on The Untold with Netflix. And we're currently funding and working with potential partners to do a Drive to Survive of chess, right? Cool. What is that going to look like? Because the world is so fascinating. And it's, do I really care about race cars? I don't. Do I watch Drive to Survive? I do, and I love it. And I'm in love with the different drivers and teams and the whole drama. But the world of chess, and as someone who's inside the world of chess, 10 times more fascinating than the world of Formula One. I'm just going to say that.
Wait, why? Why do you say that?
Yeah, exactly. We don't have time for it, but I'm going to put a show and you're going to watch it and you'll be like, Eric, I had no idea that chess was this crazy.
All right. We're 3 minutes from the end here. I think this has been a fascinating discussion.
Eric, this has been super fascinating. I've learned so much. I almost felt like I should be taking notes. And then I'm like, wait, this is a podcast. I can go back to it and listen to what Eric had to say.
Thank you for your time, Eric. It's been really cool to hear from you and hear so much about your story. And I think it will be hopefully inspiring to other people trying to build something from the ground up.
Thanks for listening to this week's episode with Eric Alabes from chess.com. This week, we did this as a single episode instead of two parts. Next week, we'll be back for a great conversation with Penelope Talbot-Kelly, who is a GM at DoorDash, and maybe some special guests. I'll let you know when we get there next week.